Fourth Aliyah of Vayeshev is yet another reminder of the value of our plan of focusing on one Aliyah at a time, because this is Aliyah which not only could easily get skipped in focus in a parsha which really is so much otherwise about Mechiras Yosef and its clear consequences, and this is an Aliyah which seems to be, at least on the surface, of a different subject, so this is an Aliyah which certainly could get skipped in terms of people's attention in this week's parasha, but also it's an Aliyah that normally gets skipped in elementary school. So there's also a lack of full appreciation as to what is here, and there is really so much that we can try to look into in the time that we have, and we'll try to get a little bit of a sense of what's going on. And just first and foremost, the question is indeed, what is it doing here? This seems to be a break from the story. It seems to be something totally of a different subject, and it's not chronological. There's no other clear reason why this is in the middle of the story of Yosef. And there's a lot of discussion about this, as you can imagine. And, for example, Rav Asher Weiss in his Sefer Al HaTorah has, in the back, he has sichos, which are different than the halachic essays. So he has an essay about this there. And the Rashiv of Karen Biavdur of Goldwicht has a major essay about why exactly this story is here. And to a certain extent, it reflects something about the theme of the Parsha, or maybe to a big extent, as we'll see. But one of the themes of the Parsha is that there is a notion of being subject to the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the forces that guide history, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan is giving us a push in a direction despite what we may or may not be aware of or what our intentions may be. And that's certainly one of the major themes that we find in the Parsha. And there is a Medrash that's quoted here, which is also just a very unusual type of language, where the Medrash kind of sets up the whole story of all the different characters in the Parsha, essentially, and says that here you have Yosef is doing his thing, and Yaakov is doing his thing, and Reuben is doing his thing, and Yehuda is doing his thing, and what's going on? Well, all that's happening, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is busy creating the light of Mashiach. So that whole painting of the picture is a very unusual kind of presentation here, and perhaps it's also a part of the message that there is a HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan, there is a destiny here, and we play our roles, most of the time not really appreciating what they are, and that's clearly a big part of the theme of the story of Yosef, where there is so much that fits that, and you kind of feel, especially when you're reading this parsha, it's a very dramatic parsha, and there's a lot of language of foreshadowing, and sometimes you almost feel as if there is music playing in the background telling the audience what's going to happen next, and you're wondering as Yosef is going down to meet his brothers, and he's even confronted by somebody who basically, according to Chazal, seems to be telling him what's going to happen, and you're thinking, doesn't he hear the music? Doesn't he understand where the character is going here? So there's a whole picture that is presented that is perhaps one of the major themes of the Parsha, and that seems to be the case here also, that we're being told that all of this is a part of a plan, and the force of Jewish history is bigger than any one of us. And Rashiv and his Sifa, so he noted, we're not going to go through this Aliyah pasuk by pasuk because there's so much to say and it'll take a longer time, but the language, the way the Aliyah begins, Vayhi Vayesahi, already that's kind of dramatic at that time. So Vayered Yehuda Mi'esachav, Vayet Arish Adulami Ushmo Chira. So he went in a path, but that language of Vayet usually means you go off a path. So that itself, Reshiva noted, is part of the whole message here, that you may think you're going in one direction and you're pointed in another direction, and that's a part of what's happening in the background, or what's happening as far as some of the major themes here. And I know there are many Talmidim here in this room, Rabbi Jesse Horn, and he has a beautiful sefer called The Double Take, Double Take Volume 2, where he talks about this extensively, and he notes the many parallels and contrasts in the story of Yehuda here in the Salia and the story of Yosef throughout the Parsha, many of which you may notice, many of which may not notice. It's certainly worth reading, a very extensive essay where he lists a very long list of points of comparison, of linguistic comparisons, of aspects of the story that parallel, and also some that seem to be opposites. And it clearly is a drawing of a relationship, both in terms of the idea that there are lessons to be derived, but also that one is a consequence of the other. And to that extent, there are midrashim that are pretty explicit about this, a midrash that tells us that Hashem basically said to Yehuda, you fooled your father Yaakov with a goat, and now you're going to end up being fooled with a goat. So the notion that there is a direct linkage, morally and responsibility-wise, from the episode of selling Yosef and this episode of what happens to Yehuda here, and also the lesson of Haker, where Yaakov is asked to recognize Yosef's coat and Yehuda is asked to recognize the simanim, it certainly seems like there is a very overt intention here to make sure that we see that there is a connection and that there is a theme. And as he writes there, by Horn, that this, essentially the story is like a pit in the middle of the parsha, kind of like the board of Yosef. You have the story interrupting in the middle and taking us seemingly in a different direction. So he talks about this at length. It's very worth reading. But a part of what he notes as the takeaways as to why the Torah is contrasting and highlighting this comparison between the two. So certainly a part of it is, again, the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan and that we are playing a role in. And that's true both for Yehuda and for Yosef and for everything that happens to them. But also the message to help us appreciate that there's a causation here and that what Yehuda is experiencing is a consequence of what he allowed to happen and the role that he played in terms of the selling of Yosef, and also the fact that that leaves a stain on an individual, that that leaves a person with a negative impact. So a lot of the behavior in this aliyah, where it seems that he's acting in a selfish manner, it seems like he's not fully aware of the consequence or appreciative of the consequences of his actions, that also is kind of the after effect of what he allowed himself to do in that context of the Mechiras Yosef. And that idea, it's worth dwelling on for a moment, just to expand upon, that the idea that there is an effect on the neshama. So you note to the Meshech Chachma, if you look at the Meshech Chachma, it's interesting the way he portrays it, that the Meshech Chachma talks about the fact that there is a discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. There's a whole sugya there about Pshara, and the Gemara tries to figure out, is Pshara a good thing or a bad thing? And it uses a different word for it there, Pitzia, and the whole question about whether it's better or worse if you come to some kind of a middle plan. And it talks about Yehuda in that context. So there it applies the Pasuk, from Tehillim, of Botzeh Berech, Neitz Hashem, that somebody who blesses, it sounds like somebody who blesses a compromiser is blasphemizing, in a sense, and talks about Yehuda as the reference there. So there's a whole discussion what the Gemara does with that. But as the Meshech Chachma understands, he says the point is that we have to appreciate that Yehuda still has to be criticized for his behavior, even though it worked out for the best, and even though that's what Yosef tells him in the end of Parshas Vayechi, that it worked out for the best, Atem Chashavtem Alei Ra, and Kadosh Baruch Hu Chashav Li Elokim Chashav Li Tova, that you tried to hurt me, but God had a different plan. So that whole idea that there is, even though there is a benefit, even though it works out for the best, but there still is an impact on the individual, and that still is a very significant point. And just to focus on that for a moment, because there's a point that I think sometimes gets a little bit misunderstood or could probably disagree with, that on that pasuk in Vayechi, where Yosef says, okay, you wanted to hurt me, I understand, but God had other plans, so it all worked out. So it sounds like he's telling them, it's okay, don't worry, you don't have to apologize, you don't have to feel bad, because ultimately it was for the best. And the Orach Chaim there has a comment which makes the question a little bit stronger, because it sounds like he's describing what Yosef is saying is, okay, it's as if like you tried to poison me, but the cup got switched, so I ended up drinking something else, like it happened in the movie, so don't worry, everything's fine. And later Sfarim question the Orach Chaim, it's a very difficult idea. You're saying that attempted murder is not a crime. You're saying it's, as long as it works out in the end, it's fine. So there are some who connect this to a yesod that you find in the Achronim, which we can spend a second on because it actually connects to Hanukkah. So let's try to get a little bit of Hanukkah in by saying a word about this yesod. There is a halach in the very beginning, Hilchos Hanukkah in the Shulchan Aruch, which is based on the Rambam, where the Rambam has the language that the mitzvah of Hanukkah is so chaviv that we have to go to great lengths to perform it, and even if we don't have any money and we have to be shol al psachim, we have to beg on, we have to knock on doors, sell our clothes, whatever it takes, we have to perform the mitzvah of Neris Chanukah. And everyone asks that that's a very surprising rule, because normally when it comes to even mitzvahs min HaTorah, there's a limit to how much you're expected to spend on a mitzvah, even a mitzvah min HaTorah. And here, Hanukkah is a din d'rabbanan. So the Magid Mishnah points out the source for this is the Mishnah in Pesachim that seems to say also that one has to ask for tzedakah for dalei kosos. And apparently it's a klal by Pursuma Nisa. Mitzvahs that are about Pursuma Nisa all require us to go above and beyond. But it doesn't really answer the question. It just recategorizes the question, because the Pursuma Nisa mitzvahs are also all drabanan, Mikra Megillah and dalei kosos, Hanukkah candles. So still, why does that have a higher standard of effort that's required than even mitzvos min HaTorah? So there are different explanations. I just want to make sure to finish this point. So there are different explanations as to why this is, but the Avnei Nezer has a tshuva, which is very similar to a yisod that many achronim have. And the way the Avnei Nezer explains it, just to mention what this yisod is, that there are a number of achronim who assume that there are different rules for mitzvos ben adam l'chavero and mitzvos ben adam l'makom. And that mitzvot ben adam l'chavero are essentially more chomer, in a way, because when it comes to mitzvot ben adam l'makom, so we have a klal of onus rachmana patre, that Kadosh Baruch Hu can credit our intentions. So a lot of policies, a lot of rules are based on that, are based on that idea. But that rule doesn't apply, apparently, many achronim assume, in the same way to a mitzvah ben adam l'chavero, because even though, yes, you can only do what you can do, but people cannot credit your intentions. They don't know what you're trying to do. All they know is that they're not getting the results they need, or they're being hurt, or they're suffering. And therefore, the results take on much greater significance. So for that reason, you have to make sure that they actually happen. So the Avnei Nezer thought that Pursuma Nisa is the same kind of thing. It's not really a Ben Adam L'Chavero, but it involves other people. It involves communicating with other people. So therefore, it has to actually happen. We can't rely on whatever excuses. So the idea is a limit to how much you have to spend. That is a din of onus, essentially. That we're saying, okay, if you can't perform the mitzvah because it's too expensive, you're going to go bankrupt. So then that's essentially, it's out of your hands. It's essentially an onus. So Kadosh Baruch Hu will credit your intentions. But human beings can't credit your intentions. Let's say you can't afford Hanukkah candles. So what's going to happen? You won't light any, and somebody will walk past your house and they'll say, well, I don't see any Hanukkah candles there, but I assume he probably wanted to, but he couldn't afford it, so I'll tell myself about the mitzvah, I'll tell myself about the nes. It's not going to work. Human beings need there to actually be the effort, need to actually have the results, and not just the effort. So some understand that, and I think it's not the full picture, some understand that to say that the whole din of Ibn Adam al-Chavero is about the results. So that's also the pshat on the Sora Chaim, the pshat on what Yosef said, that it doesn't matter what you had in mind, the fact that you were trying to hurt me isn't the issue, because the result was good. HaKadosh Baruch Hu took care of me, so that's all good. So this is a reflection of this Yisod. A number of Sfarim say that this is a reflection of this Yisod, that when it comes to Ben Adam L'Chavero, we only care about the results. So I would question if that's really the way to read it, because I don't think it means we only care about the results. I think it means, yes, we have to care about the results more, but it's really a chumrah in both directions, because we have to care about the results more than we do by even mitzvot ben adam l'makom, but we also have to care about the intent even more. I'll just finish this point, because the issue is that especially, and this is a point the Rambam makes in a different context in Shemana Prakim, and you find it in a number of places in other contexts, that when it comes to the mitzvot that we relate to, the mitzvot sichlios, so then identifying with them is even more important than the chukim. The chukim, okay, we can just perform and say it's Gezeres HaBorei, and we'll do the mitzvot without understanding them. But when it comes to a mitzvah that's rational, that we can understand it, the mitzvot sichlios, so there all the more so it's important that we actually understand and relate to what's going on. So I think it's not a kula, it's a chumra in both directions. So there is the idea that, yes, we have to worry about results more, so that's a chumra, but it's also a chumra in the other direction, that it's more important that we have the right intentions and that we connect to what's going on. So that's related to what the Meshech Chacham is saying here, that, yes, it worked out well, what Yehuda did. But that's not an excuse. So you can't praise him and you can't say that's fine. There's still a effect of the fact that his machshava was not so pure. So here too we see that he's paying the price for this. That essentially the fact that it had an effect on his soul and that it made him a little bit of a less sensitive person, a little bit less of a outwardly aware person, and that's something that shows up in his aliyah. It was a discussion, actually somebody asked me about this episode yesterday, because he's teaching in like Sim's class, talking about the concern that some of the Rabbanim had against communism, that even in Timsi Lomer, that communism was a perfect system in terms of effectiveness, obviously that's a big if, but even in Timsi Lomer, that it actually took care of everybody in a perfect way, so still Rabbanim said that wouldn't be satisfactory to us as far as our concerns for chesed, because we have to be involved personally in chesed, and communism, by not allowing private property, doesn't give any individual the opportunity to be involved in chesed, and therefore it would be a problem. Therefore, it would be missing something huge. So one of the students asked, so, but what about this idea, we really care more about the results? So that's what I was responding then also, that yeah, we care also about the results, but the idea that we have to be involved personally is also part of it, is also even more intense when it comes to mitzvah adam l'chaveiro, and that's why the Rambam writes in his commentary to Pirkei Avos that when one's giving out tzedakah and he has a certain amount to give, even though it's going to be the same amount no matter what, so the result is going to be the same, but he still should give it out in smaller gifts many times rather than one big gift, because every act is going to impact on his neshama, every act is going to make him a more sensitive person, and that's something that we're very caring about, that's something that we care very much about, that we want to hold on to. So here's what we see also, so the fact that the results worked out, that's not going to save Yehuda from criticism or for the impact on his neshama, and that's also what we see going on here. So that's also perhaps a major theme, and there's a lot more that we will come back to in terms of how this story plays specifically here, connects to some of the other themes in the parsha. And it's also noteworthy that another major theme in this aliyah is the idea of Yibum. And that mitzvah of Yibum, which is itself a mitzvah of many different levels, it's a mitzvah which we don't see performed too much. First of all, hopefully the circumstances shouldn't happen too often, the tragic circumstances, very tragic circumstances, so we don't want them to come up. But even when they do come up, we don't perform Yibum b'zman hazeh for a number of reasons, but which is also relevant. But the theme of Yibum is very crucial, and perhaps even more than a lot of other things. And the idea that Yibum is being emphasized here, so what exactly is the mitzvah of Yibum itself a note? And Rav Chaim Friedlander in a Sefer Sifsei Chaim has a lot to say about the theme of Yibum here, and about how the notion of Lahakim Shein, the whole idea, what exactly does that mean? So we have different understandings of the Rishonim. Rashi talks about that a baby that will come from the Yibum relationship is going to be named after the Nifter, but the Ramban points out that that's not the din, it's not what we find, and that doesn't seem to be the idea of Yibum. So what is the idea of Yibum is difficult, because if it's not about the name, it sounds like it's about the name, so how exactly do we understand it? So apparently, as the Ramban talks about in length, and as the Sifrei Chaim talks about, that it's about the notion of Nachla, which we talked a little bit about yesterday, and talking about what the theme of Nachla is. But that whole idea is that a person's efforts in this world, they want them to continue through to the next generation, and that's why there is this notion that his assets should be passed on to the next generation so that they can carry on what he had wanted to do in his lifetime. And that's also the idea of the mitzvah of Yibum, that there should be a continuation of his goals and of his spiritual aspirations. So if that's the idea, so really it's connected to Yerushim, as the Ramban discusses, so it could have gone to any of the Yorshim. And Kodem Matan Torah, apparently that was the idea, that it went to other Yorshim also. But after Matan Torah, when we have rules, so it got much more complicated, because there's an erva involved, so it was limited only to the brother, where this is felt most powerfully, but the theme, the idea, is one that would have made sense for any of the Yorshim, so that's what we're finding here, in the idea that Yehuda could have been a candidate for this as well. So this notion of Yibum is also very important as far as its theme, as part of its imagery, and there is a whole essay about this in the Sefer Ma'am Shek Al HaTorah, which is taken from Drashos, not here, but in Parshas Lech Lecha, because Chazal say that when Avram was offered all of the rewards of the war by the king of stone, and Avram said, I can't take it, I'm not interested in any of this, not even a shoelace. So Chazal in one place say that because of that, he merited that they should have the mitzvah of Yibum, which involves shoes, or chalitza involves shoes. So the idea of Yibum and chalitza as a reward for that, so that's a mysterious idea. Chazal in other places have different rewards for what Avram declared at that point. But the Maram Shik has a whole essay about this. Maram Shik was one of the great Talmidim of the Chassam Sofer. And he notes that here Yibum, again, it should be more theoretical than practical, but the idea of Yibum is that it reflects the ultimate chesed to somebody else, that here a person's whole desire is to pass on what he has and what he's about to the next generation. And somebody who's not able to do that, so the biggest chesed is to step in and try to do that on his behalf. And when it comes to Yibum, so there is a very strong concern that it be Lishma, that it be only with the proper intentions, and that's why, especially by the Ashkenazim, we don't do Yibum B'zman HaZeh, because of the opinion of Abba Shaul and Yibamos, that if there is anything less than pure intent, so then it goes back to being an Erva. So the intent of Yibum is very important. So the Maram Shik explains that that's the idea that why Avraham is rewarded for this when he says that I don't want to take anything for having saved Lot. So here Avraham steps in and helps a close relative and does what he can to save this relative. And he's totally lishma. He's not motivated by anything else. So that's the ideal of this mitzvah of Yibum. So one suggested also, when we had a siyum here a few years ago on Seder Nashim for Daf Yom, and I mentioned then the thought that the organizing of Seder Nashim reflects this in a sense, that here we're learning Gittin this year, and we talked about that a little bit in the whole context of how Seder Nashim plays out, but Yivamos comes first. Now, there's different reasons for what comes before what else in different Siddurim and Shas, but perhaps a part of the idea is that all of Seder Nashim is not really about women, it's about family, about Yishto Zobeso, so the whole Seder is about creating the family relationship. So we start off the Seder learning about Yevamos, which is most profoundly about the idea of what it is that makes a relationship exist. And it's the first Mishnah lists off all the relationships, but it also reflects the idea of what is a relationship, what is it really about, and how you are there for each other. So we'll take questions afterwards, I'm afraid of running out of time. So the idea here that this is right smack in the middle of the parsha is, again, is a corrective to the failure to be there for a brother and to betray a brother in the way that Yehuda did. So here the whole mitzvah of Yibum, which is really the opposite theme, is really about coming and being there for a brother in the most profound way possible, is very much part of the whole theme of this being a corrective for the episode with the selling of Yosef. It's also noteworthy just in terms of also the family ideas that are in this Aliyah. So this is just in the middle here, but it's just also interesting that Yehuda says to Tamar, "Yomar Yehuda l'samar kalaso shvi almana." That you should sit as an almana in your father's house until Shayla goes up. So that word almana, so apparently this is the first time it appears in the Torah. And the Gemara Maseches Ksubis has a pretty surprising comment about this, where Gemara Daf Yudah Mebeis, that it says the word almana is the word for a widow, because this represents the idea that Asidin Chazal Atakin Aleh Ksubas Mana, that Chazal would in the future create for her a ksuba of 100. And the ksuba for a psula is 200, the ksuba for a amana is 100, and this is a din d'rabbanan, so that's why it's so surprising, and it's a whole discussion as well, the notion that the Torah would be merames to a din that's going to come later, a din that's going to be enacted by Chazal, but that this is supposed to represent this notion of the ksuba. So there's a lot to say about the ksuba, but there's also a little bit of synergy for our Maseches Gittin. So we talked at the beginning of the year about how the theme of get, especially with the Rambam Mar Nevuchim, is to emphasize the importance of stability in the family and commitment in the family. So the whole notion of the ksuba, which we assume is drabanan completely, ksuba for almana and ksuba for basula, we assume is drabanan, but there was one opinion in the Rishonim, the Ramatam, and sounds like also maybe from the Gemara that there is a notion of ksuba min haTorah. The Rambam's language is a little bit mysterious on this front. So the idea that even if the specifics of ksuba is a din d'rabbanan, but the notion of a ksuba is hinted to us from the idea of min haTorah. And here there's a sefer Mital Shamayim that talks about the significance of almana being merumas here, that there's also a discussion that maybe the ksuba for an almana is of a whole different nature than the ksuba for a basula. So the idea that there's actually a remez for almana gives it a greater status than maybe we would have thought, and that could perhaps have implications for how it's addressed. But that being the case, so there is a message here that this notion that Chazal would formalize later reflects ideas that are already in the Torah, and this is an extension of the idea of Kedushin and the idea of Gittin, the idea that we want to make sure that there is stability and commitment in marriage, and that all of that should be valued. So that's also a huge part of it. So these are some of the major themes in the Aliyah, but there's a huge major theme in the Aliyah, which impacts our halacha today also, and that takes on a lot of questions and a lot of meaning and a lot of implications. And that is that the fact that when Tamar wants to save herself, apparently, from receiving the sreifa, from being executed for her suspected adultery, so to speak, or going outside the Yibum requirements, and that's what she's being accused of. So she knows that it was Yehuda, and she's able to get him to acknowledge that. And that acknowledgement is, in fact, the major gvura of Yehuda. So the fact that he is called Yehuda is itself reflective of the fact that he is moda, that he's able to acknowledge, and that's where his gadlus comes from, because we all make mistakes and we all stumble, but the fact that we're able to acknowledge a mistake and to step up is where real strength comes from, and the whole Jewish people take their name from Yehuda, take their name from this quality of hodah, which of course is the major theme of Hanukkah as well, so that's also a little bit of a connection, and the theme of hodah is the key notion of Hanukkah. That's why we light Hanukkah candles for Hodah. And you might say it's a different usage of the word, that Hodah means thank you rather than confessing, but it's often been pointed out that they're not different usages of the word, because confessing means that you have a chov to somebody else, and Hodah is also an act of confession, to acknowledge that you needed somebody else, that you're different because of somebody else. That is confessional. So this whole theme of Hanukkah being so crucial and expressing Hodah, Holy Yontif about Hodah, and we name ourselves after Yehuda, so Yehuda's ability to come forward and confess is what is so highly significant here. But the Gemara learns out a halacha that seems, or apparent halacha, that's itself something we'll have to figure out, that is very hard to understand on many, many levels. And the Gemara says that it sounds like Tamar used this indirect way to get Yehuda to come forward and to acknowledge that he was the one who was responsible here. And it sounds like if he wouldn't have come forward, then she would have let things just proceed. She would have let herself be executed. And that's pretty surprising. So the Gemara says here, Noach lo le'adam she'alvim p'nei chaveh, Noach lo le'adam she'apil asma l'kivshin shel eish, v'yal ya'alvim p'nei chaveh v'rat. The Gemara appears in Bav Metzia, perhaps most prominently in the end of Perek Hazav. Appears in a number of other places in Shas as well. It's in Pesachim, in Sota, in Brachos, it's all over the place. But perhaps most well-known from Bav Metzia. So that idea that apparently it's preferable for a person to allow himself to be executed rather than to embarrass somebody else in public is shocking on many, many levels. And we'll have to try to figure out if there's any halachic reflection there, but if there's any halachic implications. But there's so much to try to understand. It should also, it's interesting to note, there is one view in the Rishon Pekabira Chassid that she wasn't actually looking at execution, and the idea of her being burnt was actually because they used to brand people. Now, that was a form of punishment, so she was going to be branded. But it doesn't sound like that from the Gemara. It doesn't sound like that from a lot of other sources. That's certainly not the more common understanding. So it sounds like she was really going to be executed, and she was willing to allow that to happen to avoid embarrassing Yehuda. So there are a number of major questions that come forward from this. So whether this is actually practical on any level or not, so we'll talk about that in a second. But before that, so the question could be, how do we understand the details of the story? And there's so many questions. The Maram Shif notes that here in Bav Metzia and in Ksubis, where it comes up again in Samach Zayin, that he says more about it in Ksubis, that first of all, how do we even know that she had an option? Because maybe either he would come forward on his own and it wouldn't be that halbana, or she would maybe then, if he didn't come forward, maybe she would have said what she had to say, but then maybe he would have denied it, and then it wouldn't have made a difference anyway, and he would have been believed instead of her. So there's a whole back and forth how to understand those details of the story. The Maral Diskin suggests that maybe the big Mesiris Nefesh that she did here was that she sent the Simanim with somebody else, so she basically gave up her evidence. So if that person decided to betray her, so then she wouldn't have any more proof, and maybe that was the issue. There's a whole complexity here and just trying to figure out the details of the story, but probably the biggest question is that even if we could accept that there's a din of Yeharig Val Yavor for Habanas Pene Chaver Barabiv, itself pretty shocking, but how could it be that it applies even in this case, if you're on trial for your life, so you're not allowed to save yourself by identifying who's really responsible? Can't be that that's halacha l'maisa. So that's a big discussion. Rav Asher Weiss has a lot to say about this in his sefer. A lot of mefarshim struggle with this. Really a very difficult question. There's a sefer came out more recently, Chamuda Yitzchak. It's written by a son-in-law of Rav Zalman Nachem Goldberg, so the grandson-in-law of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And he quotes from them very often, very nice stuff in the sefer. And he has essays in the back. He has a whole essay also really working on this question. And as many do, and many also end with Tzarchin, that it's still very difficult to have a good answer to how this could be halacha l'maisa here. So, or how, especially in this context of a trial, that the trial is meant to find justice, and you can't save yourself by contributing to the justice and by saying who it was. It's very, very hard to imagine that that's the din. So there are some who say that the Prima Gadim has in a sefer Tevas Goma, who others say like this, that this is not really the din, but what she did was the Fnimashur Sadin, that she decided to be Moser Nefesh voluntarily in order to save him from embarrassment. So that's difficult on a lot of levels also. First of all, is that permissible? Also, if so, then how do we learn a halacha from this if it's not really the din? So perhaps we could break it up a little bit, and we could say a few things, that maybe we don't necessarily actually learn the halacha from here, because there are other possible places where, if there is a din, we have to see that too, but if there is, it could come from other possible ideas. And the story of Tamar maybe is not to show us that's the din, and the Gemara doesn't actually explicitly say that that's the din. The Gemara says, Noach lo la'adam, that it's preferable for a person to go through this. So maybe that's the point, that she didn't necessarily have a chiyuv to do this, but she was so committed to not being mevazahim that she therefore willingly took on this sacrifice, or was ready to take on the sacrifice. So the Gemara is deriving from that point, because it's an unusual language anyway. So the Gemara is not telling us that you see from here that you're chayiv to, but that noach lo, that it's preferable. So she willingly chose this, and that has its own implications. So that's taka, a whole discussion. Because the question of, is there any halach l'mais about this? So the implication that there's some kind of Yehariv l'yavur rule for Habanus b'nei Chaver v'Adim. So is that the case? So I'll first start with a disclaimer. Do not try this at home. Do not assume that this is a practical halacha. But it's worth noting that there is quite a discussion about it. And presumably it doesn't only come from this, but the Gemara in Bava Metzia specifically is focusing there on the Isra of Anas Dvarim, which is one of the two Isurim that is the basis for the prohibition of embarrassing people in public, as the Tashbetz points out in his Magen Avos to Pirkei Avos, where the Mishnah there says, Ha'al b'nei chaveru rabim ein lo chelek olam haba. So the Tashbetz points out there's two Isurim. There's the Isur of Onas Dvarim, and there's also the Isur of Lo Sisol of Chet, that the Pasuk about Tochacha in Parshas Kedoshim ends off, you should give tocha, but lo sisol of chet, you shouldn't be in trouble yourself because of the tocha. And the Gemara Erechin understands that yachal yishtan upon it, maybe you might think that you should give tocha, even if it means the person's face is going to change color, you're going to humiliate them. So Talmud Lomar, no, lo sisol of chet, and as the Rambam notes, there's a kal v'chomer for every other situation, that even when you're supposed to give musar, even when you have an obligation to set someone straight, you shouldn't do it in a way that's going to embarrass them. So kal v'chomer when you don't have a mitzvah, certainly you shouldn't take it upon yourself to embarrass somebody else in public. So you have the Yisurim from there, but this story is telling us maybe something about the severity of it. But the notion that the Gemara has over there, separately from this really, is that there is a comparison between humiliation and death, that Hamal Pnei Chavei Barabim is compared to Shvichas Damim. So that prompts the whole discussion. What does that mean? Do we mean that that's a figurative comparison, like maybe it sounds like it's a way of saying it's really, really bad? Or do we actually mean it's even a literal comparison, that it has all of the consequences and all of the implications of actual Ritzicha? So we'll get a second. So I'm going to take the question to the end because we're going to run out of time. But so the notion that there is some kind of an actual comparison here is very striking. We have to try to understand what that's talking about. So it seems more likely like the Lashon of emphasis. But there are some who understand that it's a literal language and that we're really comparing it to act of Ritzicha. So that's a question, first of all, how to understand that. So it could be because it can be so severe. And we do know that, Rahman al-Islam, throughout history, there have been people who have chose death rather than humiliation. That it could be that either that means that for at least some people, in some circumstances, the pain of humiliation really is for them worse than death, and they show that with their actions, or maybe that's tied to the concern that it could lead to actual physical death. Maybe that's what it means. But there is a discussion in Rishonim how literally to take this, and a discussion in the later Svarim as well. So among the implications of the question of, so would we actually say, would we actually say that this is something that has the same din of Ritzicha? Just like when it comes to Ritzicha, you're not allowed to kill somebody else to save your life. So too, when it comes to Albanas Pnei Chaver Barabim, you're not allowed to do that even to save your life. So again, do not try this at home, but there were Rishonim that did seem to take it literally. There were some who explicitly did not. The Meiri, in a few places where this Gemara comes up, the Meiri says a couple times that this is Lashon Guzma, that this is an exaggerated kind of idea. It's a way of trying to give Musar, trying to appreciate what it involves, but it doesn't mean that it's actually literal. But there are Rishonim who seem to say otherwise. The one who says so most explicitly is Rabbeinu Yonah, Rabbeinu Yonah in Shari Tshuva, where he writes that that's indeed the case, that this is Avak Ritzicha, this is a part of the category of Ritzicha, and therefore it's treated with this Chumrah as if it is Ritzicha itself. And it's perhaps implicit in other Rishonim. It's a whole discussion how to count, because how in all the other Rishonim it's more implicit one way or another. So Samri the Rambam is saying it's not Yehar B'Yavar. There's a Tosus in Sota, which the Brisker Rav and others talk about, when this Gemara shows up in Sota, so the Tosus over there asks, so how come when the Gemara in Sanhedrin lists off the three Haribol Yavors, so why doesn't it list Albanus Pnei Chaver Barabim is also a Haribol Yavor? So the answer Tosfos doesn't give is that it's not literal. That's why it's not on the list. So Tosfos gives an answer, but it's not explicit in the Psukim, so they don't list things that are explicit. But if the answer is not, that it's not literal, so then it sounds like Tosfos is saying maybe that it is literal. So that's a discussion some have, but you could also say there's another second most likely answer Tosfos also doesn't give. That it seems like the more likely approach, if you think it is literal because it's Abba's Radio de Ritzicha. It's part of the din of Shichas Davim. So then it's not a question, why is it not on the list? It is on the list. Ritzicha is on the list, and this is a outgrowth of that. So it's hard to know what to glean from that Tosfos, and others don't necessarily conclude that that's what Tosfos means. So this was a big discussion, and it seems to be a Machlokas Rishonim and a Machlokas Achronim also in terms of how to read it. So one answer, which I thought was very compelling, is there was an article in one of the journals a number of years ago by the author, his name was Rabbi Pinchas Levinson, where he suggested that if you look again at that unusual language of the Gemara, Noach lo la'adam, so that's not the way you would normally say something. So he thought the message was that it's true, theoretically, humiliation could be worse than death. That there could be circumstances, and we have seen in history that that's sometimes the case, that humiliation could be perceived as worse than death, and therefore it could be treated with a certain chumrah. But you can never know in advance that that's going to happen, because there are so many variables, every person reacts differently, and the way the people around them react is differently. So therefore, we can never know that we're actually entering into such a situation. So clearly not everything that's embarrassing is equal to death. If you spill some spaghetti in your pants in the cafeteria, it's embarrassing, but no one would say that that's like Shvichas Damim. So it's clearly a matter of degree. So to know how it's going to play out, that we can't make drastic decisions based on that. We can't say that therefore you should give up your life in order to avoid this, because we can never know what's actually going to be on that level. So therefore the language of Noach Lola Adam tells us that's a theoretical point, but the halacha l'maisa, it's not something that we can actually implement. That could also be relevant to other discussions, because there are many other issues that are brought up in order to ask this question of whether it's literal or not, and how exactly to relate to it. For example, if Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a tshuva in Siman Zayin, the Minchas Shlomo, where he talks about the issue of why is it that we don't allow Chilul Shabbos in order to provide somebody, to prevent somebody from being embarrassed. We know that we command Chilul Shabbos to save somebody's life physically. So why don't we say from there also that we should allow Chilul Shabbos in order to prevent somebody from being humiliated? So he's not ready to say, we'll have to take a question after, he's not ready to say that that's actually Halach L'maisa, but his question is, theoretically, it's a good question. There actually was a tshuva in the Sefer Shemi Shimon, Shimon Pollock, where he actually took that more dramatic conclusion. He thought you would go that far, but the Shlomo Zalman certainly was a more well-known posek of recent generations, and he thought it's not the practical halacha, but why it is the question. And he notes that if it was Dindra Banan, so we would say that we would be Docha Shabbos or Dindra Banan for human dignity, because that's the din of kavod abrios. The Gemara says in a number of other places, but also many places, that kavod abrios is such an important principle that that can outweigh din of derabanan, but not the necessarily chol shabbos min haTorah. So he's not ready to say that. But the question is, why not? And his survey, by the way, the Rishonim, he thought that other than the Meiri, he thought that everyone thought that it was equal to. Was equal practically to Ritzicha. So why don't we allow Chol Shabbos? So there are a couple of approaches, but I thought this answer that Rav Levinson wrote in this article really works for that also. That theoretically it's true. Theoretically there could be a situation that could rise to the level of being comparable to Shvichas Damim. But we're not going to say as a matter of codified halacha that we should be Mechal Shabbos in general, because it's very subjective and the chances are that that's not going to be what we're talking about. But if one had reason to believe that that was what was going on, so for example, if you took the understanding that it means we're worried that somebody, Rahman al-Salam, actually will choose death rather than humiliation. So I think it's pretty pashut that if we really had a fear that somebody would take their life, so we would be Mechal Shabbos in order to save them, in order to intervene. So if we actually assume, if we have reason to think that it's on that level of severity, so then in the Hanami it would be Docha Shabbos. But just to say as a general rule that any kind of embarrassment is something we're going to be Docha Shabbos for, so it's not practical to codify it in that way, and it's not going to be the case most of the time. So that's not the baseline halacha. But in theory, this idea of Noach Lo Adam does convey just how significant it is. And there are a few other places where this discussion comes up. There was a psak that Rav Shlomo Kluger, who always has fascinating things to say, always thinks differently. So Rav Shlomo Kluger, in his commentary, Chachma Shlomo to Chosha Mishpa, the very end of Chosha Mishpa, he writes there that he doesn't think that you're obligated to save somebody else's life if it will be humiliating for you to do it. Then normally, you're obligated to save lives when you can, but if it's going to be embarrassing, he doesn't think you're mechuyev to do it. Now, he has a different way of getting to that conclusion, but it seems like that's also an example of understanding this in a more extreme way, that if we understand it's literally equal to death, so then maybe the same way you're not supposed to sacrifice your life to save somebody else, so too you're not supposed to embarrass yourself, humiliate yourself in order to save somebody else. So all the later Achronim did not accept this Chachma Shlomo. Tshuvas about this, and there's a discussion about this in the Kli Chemda, and the Tshuvas Lev Aryeh has got a discussion about this, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and that same Tshuva, so he talks about it also, and he also rejects it, even though he, like we said, he thought in general, he did think that there was a equation between Shvichas Damim and Halbanus Pnei Chaver Barabim, but he says still we wouldn't come to this conclusion, and he also notes that Gemara says in Tainus that you can't compare an embarrassment that comes from someone else in comparison to an embarrassment you take on willingly. So if somebody's going to put himself in an embarrassing situation in order to save somebody else, it's not never going to be on the same level as humiliation coming from somebody else. And as he notes also, and this is a very important distinction to appreciate, that certainly nobody would ever say that if somebody is coming to embarrass you, you're allowed to kill them as a rodeh. Right? We don't go that far. We don't go as far as that. And to say that you can take actual physical action against somebody, we know this was a big ending in the news a couple months ago in front of a billion people. So the question, can you take a physical action in front of somebody if they're saying something that's embarrassing, saying something humiliating? So we don't assume that it goes that far. We don't assume that there is a heter for killing somebody as a rodeh because they're embarrassed. So clearly there's a line there as far as how it's understood. And he also there concludes that we wouldn't say that you can't, that you're allowed to not save somebody else's life because it's embarrassed. There's also a discussion in Poskim, Zedin the Gemara has in Brachos, that a Kohen who killed somebody is not allowed to dochen. So some of the Achronim, there's a tshuva about this, and the Lahoros Nasan, Rav Nasan Gishtetner, and the Shevet Levi, Rav Osner has a tshuva about this, that should we say that a Kohen who embarrasses people should not be allowed to dochen? And that would be quite an interesting point. So they both conclude that no, we don't take the comparison that far. We don't assume that it's actually equal to Ritzicha, and we'll take a question in it or afterwards. We don't assume that it's actually equal to Ritzicha. And he said, the Rav Nasan Gishtetner writes in his tshuva that even if it were, it sounds like from the Gemara that it's specifically physical murder because it darshan's a pasuk in Yeshayahu about Yedechem Damu Maleu, that your hands are filled with blood. So specifically physical murder that you do with your hands, that's where you would have this. One could say that still, but the yes, the siyas kapayim, the hands are crucial to Berachas Konin, but also the mouth is also. So if you kill somebody with your mouth, maybe you should have the same kind of a din, but he didn't go that far. So the Shevet Alevi and the Horus Nasan didn't go that far, but there were there were some other Svarim in the library. You can find Svarim on Hilchos Nesilas Kapayim. There are some Svarim where they're pretty machmer on this question. They think that maybe you should actually consider it equal to death. But again, in practice, we don't see this being followed. But it's something to consider. And the whole notion on all of these Shilas, and especially the Yehar V'Yavor Shilas, which again, say don't try at home. But most of the times when we're considering embarrassing somebody, it's usually not because our life is at stake. So the idea that there were Rishonim and Achronim who said that even if it was Yehari V'Yavor situation, even if it was people in that situation, you couldn't embarrass somebody. So that's pretty impactful. It's pretty impressive. So certainly when it's not a situation of such risk to you, of such severity, so certainly we should understand that you can't embarrass somebody, and to appreciate the chumrah and to appreciate the severity, which is really one of the major messages that emerges from here. When the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos that Im lo chelek olam haba, and the Gemara quotes also that David HaMelech said that in response, that the whole sugya in Baronas Dvarim Bov Mitzvah, has somebody harassing David HaMelech, politicians get involved in scandals and the press won't leave him alone. So he was trying to give a shir about something unrelated, and the people in the crowd asked, so what's the punishment for somebody who gets involved with a possibly married woman, implying his own situation? So David responds, so yes, there's a chiyuv misa there, but the person can do tshuva and have a chelik olam haba. But somebody who's mevaza, somebody who's malb menechaver barab, ain't no chelik olam haba, like the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says. So where did he get that from? So got it from the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Where did the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos get it from? So that's a whole discussion of the Mefarshim, and it's interesting that it could be l'shitaso, because the Rabbeinu Yonah, in his commentary on Pirkei Avos, so he says, because it's like the tzicha. So there's no chelik in olam haba because like ritzicha, and it's even worse than a ritzeach because you're not going to do tshuva, because a person who commits murder is going to understand you did a terrible thing and he'll do tshuva, so at least he'll have a chelik in olam haba. But somebody who embarrasses people in public did something just as bad and he's not going to realize because people think this is normal, this is just the style and it's the way I talk, and they're not going to do tshuva, so that's why there's no chelik in olam haba. So it's l'shita, so it seems that this is an Avera of that level. While the Rambam probably also l'shitaso, because according to the Nosei Kelim, we'll assume that the Rambam doesn't think it's Yehari V'Yavor. So the Rambam, in his commentary to Chelek, in his Perish Mishnayis to Sanhedrin, so he explains that the idea of not having a Chelek or Olam Haba is not a one-to-one correlation, but it's basically more of an indication that if you have somebody who regularly embarrasses people in public, not just once, but he does this as a matter of course, so that's an indication that he's probably in a very specific halachic category known as a jerk, and he probably is just not on the list. He's probably not on the list anyway. So you have the list of who's a ben olam haba, so it's a good clue if you want to know. The people who go around embarrassing people in public, probably not a ben olam haba. So that's probably the Rambam l'shitaso, that it's not an aveira that by itself gets you thrown out, but it's an indication of a certain kind of personality that's not going to be so impressive. So you have this whole mentality that there's a big lesson that comes from this, and certainly Bismanenu, where the whole idea of people's dignity has been lowered to such an extent, and the whole internet digital world has created a whole different baseline expectation of where people's kavod is to be respected and to be even something we're aware of. So this requires a much greater recommitment to focus, to appreciate just how significant an issue it is. And the thought this could also explain is the story that they say that they asked Ravarn Cutler, that it seems like it's hard to understand the Kadosh Baruch Hu's plan. That here, Kadosh Baruch Hu presumably wants people to learn Torah. That's something he's very fond of. And yet, the people who are most capable and most interested in learning Torah, they can't learn anymore because they become Rashi Yeshiva of big institutions and they have to spend all their time traveling around the world raising money. So why does the Kadosh Baruch Hu want that? The people he would think are most suited to be learning Torah and most want to, instead they have to now go around raising money and they can't learn anymore. So Ravana Kotler, according to the story, had three answers. I only know two of them. So the first one is, he said that this way there's more Torah spread, because Rashi has to give shiurim in all the different places that he goes, so his Torah otherwise would have just stayed in the Dalet Amos of his yeshiva, and now he gets to go around the whole world. But the third answer he gave, I don't know what the second answer was, but the third answer he gave was that, you know, there is a din that HaRetzeach B'Shogeg has to go into Galus. So the notion that somebody who kills inadvertently is supposed to be exiled. So, if you embarrass somebody, so then that's like killing them. So sometimes you have a rabbi embarrasses a student. So he's not going to do it on purpose. He's not evil. He's not trying to humiliate the student, but it could happen, the shoge, it could happen inadvertently. So he has to go into galus. He has to go wandering around. So that's why the Rosh Yeshiva has to go traveling the world in order to be mechaper for his halbanos b'nei chaver b'rav and the shoge. So it sounds like a cute story, but I think there's probably a deep intention there, because what's the whole notion of Ritzeach b'shoge going into galus? Why is that the appropriate consequence? So one could suggest that the whole problem of Ritzeach b'shoge is not an intentional murderer, not looking to hurt anybody, but he wasn't careful enough about life. He doesn't care about people's preciousness of people's existence. He's not thinking about this all the time. So he's willing to act in a careless fashion in public. That's specifically the category that goes into galus, somebody who's neither intentional nor blameless, but somebody who's careless, essentially. So that person has to go into galus, where now he is subject to somebody chasing after him, to the revenge possibility. So now he wasn't thinking about life, and now he's got to think about it all the time. Now he's got to constantly think about the fragility of life, which he wasn't properly sensitive to before. So maybe it's the same idea here, that why is the Rosh Yeshiva going to embarrass somebody? Why is the Rebbe going to embarrass somebody? Again, he's not evil. He's not looking to hurt his feelings. But maybe the idea is that he's just not aware of the difference in status, that he's used to being in a certain position, and he's not aware that something he might say innocently, because the Talmud is in a very different position, could come across as much more painful and could be humiliating. So what's the corrective for that? So the tikkun is, he's got to go around the world. He's got to go to different people's houses, and now he's the one on the other side of the desk, and he's going to say, maybe you can help me, maybe you can give me a little bit of yeshiva, maybe you can give me some assistance. So that's going to correct the sensitivity he didn't have, what it was like to be on the other side of the desk, what it was like to be in a different social position. So he has to correct that by going through this experience. So maybe that could also be a part of what Yehuda's story is doing here, that the whole notion that Yehuda has have to have a kapara that's happening from his experience of what he did with Yosef, that's a big part of it. But also, if he's going to be a king, and that's going to be what's happening next, that he's going to be restored to the status of Malucha, so part of the problem is that a king, if he's going to be able to serve his people, he has to have some idea of what they go through. He has to have some idea of what it means to be in a position of being the one whose rights are sometimes trampled on, or the one whose dignity is sometimes squashed. So to be able to have the same kind of process happen to him, so he shouldn't feel like he's insulated, he shouldn't feel like he's protected from this, he has some kind of a sense, he has to go through what Yaakov went through, he has to go through what Yosef went through, he has to go through all of these different aspects, is a part of a process that makes him worthy of being a king, that makes him able to return to that. So this Hodah, of course, is a part of it, but also it's created by this reality that he is going to have a greater sensitivity because of what's happening to him. And maybe we could also then just say, as far as Tamar, so the idea of Noach Loli Adam, that she didn't want to embarrass him. So yes, historically, this is what had to happen. What was going on with Yehuda was this was necessary for his eventual development and his being able to continue this role as a king. But one of the other themes of the parsha we saw at the beginning is that even if it's a Kadosh Baruch Hu, one of the themes of the Saliyah is that even if it's a Kadosh Baruch Hu's plan, it doesn't mean that it's your job to inflict pain on other people in order to bring them to that stage. So yes, there is a Kadosh Baruch Hu's plan, but still we have our own sense of responsibility. That seems to be one of the major themes. So even if, yes, Yosef had to be brought down to Mitzrayim so that everything else could happen, but it doesn't let Yehuda off the hook to say, okay, therefore I can commit this act and not have to worry about it. So too, Tamar is the opposite. And yes, maybe historically this is what has to happen, and that this is the goal, and maybe doubtful he's supposed to be embarrassed. Maybe that's the whole point. But still, I don't want to be the one to do the embarrassing. I have my own personal midos to think about, so I don't want to be the one, even if it was beheter, even if it was necessary. This reflects the sense of understanding the impact it has on the neshama, and I don't want to be the one to do that. And I think I once saw in the name of Chaim Volozhiner that he commented on that equally mysterious line in the Mishnah Kedushin, the end of Kedushin, the line that gives all the Jewish mothers grief because of their aspirations they have for their children. So the Mishnah says, Tov Shabarofim Gehenim. So what does that mean? To say that the best of doctors go to Gehenim, how can we say such a thing? Clearly we don't believe that. Clearly the Jewish people don't believe that. So what does it mean to say Tov Shabarofim Gehenim? A line that many have struggled with greatly. So there are many interesting interpretations for a different time, but the one just to mention now, so the name of Chaim Volozhiner said that it means spiritual refuah. It doesn't mean a normal doctor. It means a spirit, the tov, but spiritual refuah from the Gehenna. Why? Because what's the best spiritual refuah? So it's the best refuah you can have on a spiritual level is to be humiliated. Because if you get embarrassed, so then all your avarice are cleared away, and you rethink everything also on a practical level, and you can come back a much improved person. if you go through embarrassment. But the person who would inflict such a process, the person who would administer such a refuah, is a rasha. You can't decide to do that. So he says, that's what it means. Tov shevarofim legehenim. The best refuah is to be humiliated. But the rofe who's going to humiliate someone to give him that refuah, legehenim, is going to have to pay the price. So maybe that's the idea here also, that Tamar, and it's also the theme of one of the themes of the Aliyah, that yes, there is a plan and there is a good result that can sometimes come about, but there's still an effect on your midos. There's still going to be a consequence if you're going to be the person who's going to inflict pain on someone, even when it's necessary. I don't want to be that person. So Noach lo Adam. So Tamar recognized that yes, this is what has to happen, but I'm not going to be the one who's going to make it happen. It's a part of the necessity of history, and I'm going to look out for my soul, and Noach lo Adam should bring it about a different way. And all of this contributes to some of the major themes in this very complex and highly significant Aliyah. So just like Ron Cutler said, I'll just ask Mechila that I couldn't take the questions because I'm afraid we're going to run out of time, but we'll have Mincha now, and then I can stay around if we have any more. Ask any questions. All right, should have a wonderful Shabbos and a full appreciation of the Kavod of everybody. And who's going to daven?